Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show monthly market update episode for the current month of April 2017. I'm here now with our resident expert, economist, and wealth advisor, Paul Sloat, also the founder of Green Drake Advisors, based in Wayne, Pennsylvania. Every month, Paul joins us here on the show and fills us in on the economic forces at work in the national and global economy and what those forces are expected to do to the local real estate investment markets around the United States in the short and long term. This month, Paul exposes some storm clouds on the horizon of a looming tightening of credit standards. You probably remember the stories of 2008, 2009, when all of a sudden the banks pulled all the credit lines and all the pending deals started falling out. It was absolutely demoralizing and decimated the real estate market. The time to get ready for a situation like that is right now. So anyway, let's hand it over to Paul. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Paul Sloat.
Well, thanks, Dan. Glad to be back. How is it out there in Chicago?
Well, it's about balmy, I guess, for Chicago in the 50s today, a little bit of an overcast, cloudy day. The waves are active out here on Lake Michigan outside of my window. How is the weather out there in Philadelphia, Paul?
The weather here is actually beautiful. It's 60, 62 and sunny. So how come you're not out surfing, Dan?
Ever since I moved to Chicago, I realized that that 5 to 10 degree difference, that 5 to 10 degrees warmer most days that Philadelphia has, just causes so much envy for me, at least for that angle of it. But Lake Michigan is really cool out here, and in the summertime, it's like living in a beach town, you know, volleyball, et cetera. But this time of year, I guess you'd have to be wetsuited up, and the waves aren't quite big enough to surf, but you can get out there paddleboarding and stuff like that. But I'm not that much of a water sports guy to deal with the cold water this time of year. Maybe July, August, but not now.
All right. I guess we should remind our viewers that we're taping this in early April of 2017. And I'm going to talk about a couple of subjects for which our viewers should be aware. Last month, we talked about how costs were beginning to creep up and likely would continue to creep up. It's clear from a number of appointments in the Trump administration that they will not tolerate a strong dollar, and that likely the dollar sometime over the next couple of years is going to start heading down. And when it does, it will add to inflation, especially on the commodity side. So I think the listeners should be aware of that. And that's all I'm going to say on costs. But what I did want to talk about, my major topic today, is going to be consumer credit. Now, as we all know, mortgage standards have been pretty strict since we got Dodd-Frank, and the banks have begun to lend against housing as a lagged function to the rise in home prices. However, our listeners should be aware that consumer credit outside of housing has begun to deteriorate. And it's something on which to keep an eye, because banks tend, when consumer credit deteriorates in one area, to tighten standards across all consumer products. And all consumer products would include mortgages. So to the extent we are in the business of buying and fixing up and selling houses or building houses from scratch, that should be kept quite a close eye on. So let me give you a couple of statistics to give you a sense of what we are focused on. So one of the interesting things is that delinquencies have started to rise for credit cards. And this is across sort of the credit spectrum. And delinquencies in 2016 were up about 30 basis points. About 0.3%, regardless of the issuer. So whether it was Discover or Capital One or Synchrony, Synchrony is actually the spinoff from GE that handles a lot of private label credit cards, such as those from the major department stores or other types of people like American Airlines. They don't own the card. They just use a financial provider to handle everything and put their name on it. So you should be aware that this credit is beginning to deteriorate, and it's even beginning to deteriorate in the prime levels. One area that is an issue is auto credit. And let's talk about that for a minute, because I think it could be a real problem in the next recession. So already subprime auto credit has risen back to delinquency levels last seen in the last recession. And this is even before we get to a recession. And why is that? Well, that has to do with consumer incomes and what has happened to the price of a car, and the thought by the auto companies through their financing subsidiaries that they want to sell cars to people anyway, even if the financial ratios are a bit tight. And what do we mean by that? Well, if we look at real income since before the last recession, real incomes have basically gone nowhere. So as a result, real incomes are flat. On the other hand, pricing for automobiles has gone up. So what have the auto companies done when people have flat incomes, but it costs more to buy the product? What have they done is they have tried to arrange financing over a longer period of time. Now, one of the ways they've done this is by lengthening auto loans. The rule of thumb, and anybody I know who's in the financial industry will tell you, never take an auto loan longer than 5 years, because the car will depreciate faster than you pay down your auto loan, and therefore you'll be upside down on your auto loan. So that is thing one. So they've started extending the timeline on your auto loans. Well, what's going to happen is if a consumer gets into trouble and the value of the car is less than the auto loan against it, they're just going to hand the keys back to the dealer or the finance company. So that's one thing that's going to go on. The second thing is by extending the length of time for those auto loans, that means the consumer will not be able to buy a car as often. Ergo, we have the advent of leasing. Leasing is cheaper than buying because you're only renting the car for a particular period of time. Effectively, if you were to lease and pay that lease rate to buy a car, it would take you something like 12 years to buy the car. There are issues with leasing, and one of the issues with leasing is the residual value. And what is a residual value? The residual value is the amount that the car company assumes the automobile you are driving will be worth in 2 to 3 years when that car rolls off lease. And we have commented on that before for our wealth management practice. When leasing was a very small part of the business back in the late 90s, it was less than 10% of auto sales, and therefore it was used sparingly and used in the right cases. And then starting in the mid-2000s, when people were spending lots of money on houses, well, the leasing expanded as well because they needed a lower payment on that auto in order to afford a bigger payment on the house. So auto dealers expanded their leasing. Leasing went to somewhere between 15 and 17% of all autos sold, almost doubling the share of automobiles it was servicing. Let's fast forward to 2016. Between 2007 and 2016, consumer incomes went nowhere and auto prices went up. So how do we lower that monthly nut to the consumer? Well, we lease the car. Okay, well, we now have 32 to 33%, or approximately one out of three cars is leased today. Well, when we had a small amount of sales back in 2009 and 2010 and even 2011, the amount of leases and cars that were coming off lease was small. But as we've moved forward to 2016, we go back to 2013, and the amount of cars coming off lease has started to be large. And in fact, in the next recession, if one in three cars is actually being sold on lease, and on average, we have, shall we say, 16 million cars or so. It's up to 17 million recently, but let's say 16 million cars sold 2 years ago, and we take a third of that, that's over 5 million vehicles. Well, what happened in the last recession? Sales went down to a 9 million vehicle annual rate. What happens when we try to take on 5 million cars and leases on try to sell some other cars? It's a problem for the auto company. So we think that this is a looming problem. But the bigger issue is as auto credit continues to deteriorate, other financial institutions that do not have large exposure to automobiles will start looking at this and how it's impacting the consumer's overall credit. In addition, they will start to tighten their standards for the consumer. So with credit cards deteriorating and auto loans clearly deteriorating, you have the recipe for lending institutions to tighten credit for things like mortgages and other types of consumer credit. So that is something that we would watch very carefully because it could start to have an impact on the housing market. As we have pointed out, home sales continue to be supported by the millennials, and the millennials continue to move into housing and away from apartments. And part of the way you can see that they are now starting to move into homes in a big way is if we were to look at the same store NOI reported by the public apartment companies. Those companies are reporting significantly slower same store NOI growth than they were a year or two ago. In fact, same-store NOI has decelerated from over 6%, which is where it ran pretty much from 2011 through 2015, to just 3% by the end of 2016. And it is looking like it's going to continue to run below 3%. Well, what happens if your same-store NOI is slowing, which is a reflection of slowing rent at the same time that maybe you have fewer people looking for apartments, at the same time that you may have more people looking for houses, at the same time you may have more supply coming onto the market of housing units. It is likely not a good recipe, especially if we were to add some cost pressures to the equation. And by cost pressures, I'm not talking about just materials and other things that are needed to maintain your building, but also things like labor. Labor rates have started to accelerate, and the Fed has kept track of that. And that is one of the reasons the Federal Reserve is talking about raising rates at least two more times this year, and possibly three. They're keeping a wide eye on inflation. So as this inflation perks up through the system, as the underlying employment dynamic has tightened, and as we have laid out, pressures on the cost side exist for insulation and other basic things that are needed in the housing and apartment markets. What will happen is you could potentially have a real squeeze on NOI in the multifamily sector. So we say to the readers and listeners, be careful and know what you're doing. Each market is local, so New York is not going to act like Louisville, nor will it act like Seattle. So you have to pay attention to these major forces and how your local market is reacting in the face of these forces. I'm going to have a brief comment today on the office markets. One of the interesting things and statistics that sort of popped out of the woodwork has been the tenant improvement number. So despite the fact that we have relatively good occupancy, tenant improvements have been rising at a rapid rate. In fact, they have risen year over year between 15 and 20%. And I am quite sure that rents are not up 15 to 20% year over year. They're running in the mid-single digits. So as a result, when we look at this, it appears that there could be some real pressure on the office side over the next couple of years. So that is another thing to keep an eye on with office buildings, because those cost increases are kind of hidden in the tenant improvement line. So the other interesting thing that is apparent in the office sector is that the occupancy gap has effectively shrunk between the suburban and the central business districts of major cities. As more and more people move and locate their businesses outside of a major city for both commuting purposes and for tax purposes. So, for example, if we were to come here to the Philadelphia region, you would notice that there are numerous office buildings built right across the line that demarks Philadelphia from the suburbs. Now, this is because of the tax structure in Philadelphia, which makes it difficult for businesses to justify locating in Philadelphia. And we have seen this around the country as various cities raise taxes in order to close budget gaps and to meet pension obligations. And a number of cities, if those were included in regular accounting, just like we did for companies, those cities would effectively be bankrupt. However, we're not allowed to have cities such as Chicago go bankrupt, so therefore we come up with a different solution. We raise taxes and we kick it down the line. But raising taxes is making business reconsider where they are going to locate, and they have a choice. They can be in the Chicago suburbs or they can be in the central business district of Chicago. And so you have that in Chicago and Philadelphia and a number of other cities where people are choosing to be on the outskirts in the suburbs just across the line. So I would say that is something to watch, and it's become quite pronounced, this business cycle where central business district occupancies, which used to be significantly higher than suburban occupancies, have asymptoted to suburban occupancies. It hasn't been that suburban occupancies went up. It's that central business district and Class A occupancies have dropped towards suburban occupancies. So those are the few things that I have for today, and I'm sure you have a number of questions on those, Dan.
Well, a lot of that, we know what the costs are going to do and a tightening credit. I mean, what is the position still right now, Paul, in single-family housing, you know, in light of these items we discussed today?
Well, I would say, and we have seen no beginning of a tightening of credit there yet. And here is where the but comes in. But to the extent that these other areas are beginning to deteriorate, they could affect a consumer's overall credit rating, which ultimately would impact their ability to get a mortgage. So we haven't seen any direct impact on tightening in mortgage lending yet. And so, you know, I call that to be seen.
And the number of automobiles that are being leased, I mean, it sounds like it's a classic bubble that's kind of, you know, metastasizing, if you will, in the auto industry as a whole.
Because what the auto companies did is they raised prices, but consumer incomes didn't go up. Well, that's a problem if your people are looking at their monthly payment. So how do you get them into the car? You figure out how to lower the payment. Well, how do you lower the payment? Well, we could give you a lease as opposed to a loan. And in fact, my partner in the wealth management business just ran the numbers, and he leased a car because he said, I can lease this car for such a low lease payment that in 3 years when I hand this back, there is no way the residual value is going to be anywhere close to what it should be given what I'm paying on this lease. So it was much, much cheaper for him to hand that back. And this is starting to be reflected in the pricing for used vehicles, and I'll call them newly owned used vehicles as opposed to old owned vehicles. Okay, so what's happened to vehicle prices for vehicles between 0 and 7 years, there's a couple of different series of used auto prices out there. One is the Manheim Index, which takes everything, whether a car is 1 year old up to whether it's 15 or 18 or 20 years old. And as we know, by the time a car gets to be 8, 9 years old, it's pretty fully depreciated. Even if you can run the car for 6 more years, you're not going to get much if you're in an accident and the car is totaled, and you can't really sell the car for much because of the annual maintenance. However, there's another index, the NADA index, that's the National Auto Dealers Association. That index covers cars from 0 years to 7 years. So it covers cars that are much younger, and those are really the cars that the typical dealer is concerned about, because let's say somebody pays off a car loan after 5 years and sort of keeps it for another couple of years, and then they trade it in, right? When it gets up, let's say, near 100,000 miles, if they're driving, you know, 15,000 miles a year, they'll get there in 7 years, right? If they're driving, you know, 12,000 miles a year, they'll get there in 8.5 years. So for a dealer, up to about 9 years is all they care about, because they don't deal in the older cars. That's another index, and that index was down over 7% in February year over year. So what you're starting to see is the pressure from the lag of the increase in leasing into the market, as there's pressure on credit for new cars, at the same time as lots of cars are beginning to come back to the dealers that are coming off lease and they're almost like new. So this is going to be a problem, and it's going to be a problem that's going to definitely extend into the recession, because let's say we have a recession in 2019, for example. Well, all the cars that were on 3-year leases from 2016 are going to come off, and a bunch of cars from 2017 that were on 2-year leases are going to come off, and they're going to come off and be sitting in dealers' lots, and they're going to be almost like new. And in fact, my thought for my next car, because so many cars are going to be coming off of leases, is that I'm going to buy a 2-year-old low mileage lease off car in another year or two, because there's going to be such pressure because of the volume of cars at the same time as the car dealers are trying to sell new cars. So I think that you're going to have a real problem in the auto market down the line. It really smacks of a brewing problem.
Yeah, it definitely does. Simple supply and demand extrapolated over the course of time. I leased my last car. I had a Range Rover a year ago, and I took it back within 1 year, Paul, and they gave me a new one and actually lowered the lease payment. It ended up, I leased a new one, you know, 12,000 miles, not even later, because the end of the year, and it was January, it was considered a leftover 2016, but it had better equipment. It had no mileage on it, and I traded out as a 3-year lease. And for me, you know, that was like the first new car I've gotten in quite a number of years. Well, beside, you know, the two of them in that short period of time. But that was the first time I'd leased a car, and I don't go over on the mileage. And I was, you know, happy to get out of the other car and get into a new one, no doubt. But it just seemed like it logical made sense. It wasn't even so much the payment, but more the tax benefits for me as a business owner to lease compared to tracking my mileage and, you know, all the things the IRS requires for us if we want the deductions for the automobile. So you're right. It does make sense that the auto industry is steering us as consumers toward leasing as, I guess, a solution for the problem with the rising prices.
Yes, but the problem with that, as I pointed out, Dan, is that ultimately the lease payments have to actually pay for the car. And that is probably going to lead to, in the next recession, significant write-off. That's all being hidden today, because we can say whatever the residual value is today because we're making a guess, right?
Kind of like Enron?
Not quite like Enron. Enron
was
fraud.
Asset prices?
I would say this is more like asset prices. It's we're making a loan on a depreciating asset, saying the asset's going to depreciate, let's say, 10% a year, when it's actually going to go down 15% a year. So once the lease payments are over, there's going to be what I call a mark-to-market effect that's going to happen. And so I keep an eye on this, because I think that when this starts to erupt into a real problem, it's going to cause lenders to tighten credit across the board on the consumer, because that's typically what they do first, which is shoot first and later sort out what they should be doing.
Cool. So, Paul, for listeners who might want to reach out, do you want to share some contact information, how you can be reached?
Yeah, I can be reached one of two ways. They can call our offices at 610-687-7766, and someone will return their phone call. That's one way. The other way is they can go onto our website, and we have a contact us form there, and they can fill that out, and someone will return their inquiry and get back to them within 24 to 48 hours.
All right. Well, Paul, I appreciate you blocking out this time to share with the REI Diamond Show listeners here, April 13th as a timestamp for 2017. Thank you for coming on the show, Paul.
Thank you. And I will speak to you next month, Dan.
Sounds good, Paul. And thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving an email notification when the next REI Diamond Show episode is released? You can sign up at www.reidiamonds.com, and I will send you some cool bonuses, including the book I wrote on wholesaling. Or you can also subscribe through the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Hey, do you have deals for sale? I am looking to buy deals currently in Philadelphia, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Chicago, Atlanta, and the Tampa Bay area in Florida. So you may submit deals at www.reidiamonds.com by clicking on the link at the top of the page. Thanks again for being a loyal listener of the show. Hope you learned something. Hope you enjoyed it. Dan Breslin here. Catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.